This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Chester Arthur Burnett was a man with an intimidating frame who sang with an inimitable voice.
Oh, ask her for water. Oh, she brought me gasoline.
The big guy with the big pipes to match was known as Howlin' Wolf. He was catapulted to fame in the 1950s with songs like I Asked Her for Water, Smokestack Lightning, and Moanin' at Midnight. Wolf's earliest recordings were released on Chess Records out of Chicago, but he was discovered in Memphis by Sun Records founder Sam Phillips, who would go on to discover legendary artists like Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Johnny Cash. Of all the talent he worked with, Sam regarded Howlin' Wolf as the greatest. Howlin' Wolf's been honored at the Grammy Hall of Fame, the Blues Hall of Fame, and now the University of North Carolina is taking its turn at paying tribute to the music of this Delta Blues icon. On Monday, a symposium concert and a concert going to be held on the campus in Chapel Hill to celebrate the life and legacy of Howlin' Wolf. My guest today will be part of the festivities. Music scholar Peter Gorelnik has written extensively on the blues in general and Howlin' Wolf in particular. He had an opportunity to see Wolf in concert a number of times before his death in 1976. Peter Gorelnik joined us by phone now. Welcome to the State of Things, Peter.
Well, thanks, Frank.
Howlin' Wolf got his start as a recording artist in Memphis, but certainly the music comes from Mississippi, where he was born. Tell us a bit about those early years and how he got involved in the blues.
Well, he was somebody who lived on the farm almost all of his life. When he showed up at Sam Phillips' recording studio, Memphis Recording Service, 706 Union Avenue, where not just Elvis and Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee Lewis were recorded, but great blues singers like Little Junior Parker, Bobby Blue Bland, B.B. King, those were all of Sam's earliest recordings. But Howlin' Wolf was 41 years old when he first came to the studio in 1951, and he had never appeared professionally. He had played on the plantations, he had played at little juke joints, he had played, as he said, all night for a fish sandwich and glad to get it, but he had only recently decided to cast his lot with the life of a professional music man and moved to West Memphis, where he had a radio show selling agricultural feed and agricultural tools and implements. And that was where Sam first heard him, on the radio on KWEM in West Memphis.
And Wolf, we said he was a big guy, but how big?
Well, when Sam met him in 1951, he was probably 6'3", 220, 230 pounds. By the time that I saw him about 15 years later, he was weighing in at about 300 pounds. As one of his songs said, 300 pounds of heavenly joy. And he also said 300 pounds of muscle in man, and I think that was the more important thing to him.
Well, and that was the point, is that he's a formidable figure on the stage, right? I mean, he did a show, and people didn't forget it.
Well, I would say of all the performers that I've ever seen, Wolf, along with James Brown, Jerry Lee Lewis, Solomon Burke, another heavyweight, but I'd say those four are far and away the greatest, the most charismatic figures I've ever seen on stage. And Wolf, in a way, had the most daunting task because he had to command the stage all by himself.
Mm. Yeah, and he held that guitar. It looked like a fiddle hanging off his chest. He was so big. A big guy.
Yeah, well, I mean, even more so when he played harmonica, which is his main instrument. I mean, he might as well have swallowed the harmonica.
Right.
And we'll have a... anyway, he was just an astonishing performer, a galvanizing performer, and I think the first time I ever saw him was in this little basement club. It was a folk club in Cambridge called Club 47, and seating capacity no more than 125,
wow.
And it seemed like Wolf was going to bring the roof down around us.
He was immortalized in that 2008 film Cadillac Records, and in that movie they had this explanation for how he got his nickname.
Was the big bad wolf. Now story is he got his name from a dead man who came out the cemetery and tuned his guitar. And he been howling at the moon ever since. Oh,
stop your train. All right, that's their story. What have you heard?
Well, I think Wolf himself would stand up in fierce opposition to that story. It sort of contradicts everything that he would ever have said or stood for. Although the actor who played Wolf was phenomenal in Cadillac Records, the way he became Howlin' Wolf professionally was that there was a singer named J.T. Smith, J.T. Funny Papa Smith, who recorded a song called Howlin' Wolf Blues in 1931, and that became Wolf's theme song. Mm. One of the reasons, or maybe the principal reason, he picked it up was because as a kid, he had been scared of wolves. I don't think there were any wolves left in the hill country at the time, but people would tell stories about wolves, and he expressed such fear that his grandfather would tease him and gave him the nickname Howlin' Wolf. But the professional name, I think, came directly from that recording and from Wolf adopting the recording as his theme song.
Well, certainly Howlin' Wolf has its charm and its mystery, but I actually think the more interesting story is the fact that his given name is Chester Arthur Burnett, named after President Chester Arthur.
Presumably so, and I don't know how many kids were named after Chester Arthur. I mean, we'd have to go back and do serious research on that, and I would think the University of North Carolina Center for Documentary Research, you know, should get on this right away.
Well, the only other interesting story is Blind Millard Fillmore Jefferson, but that's a story for another time, I think. tell us, you talked about Sun Records. He never really recorded on Sun Records, although
Sun Records didn't exist when he recorded for Sam Phillips. Sam Phillips had no interest in having a label of his own in his dream. Sam opened up his studio on the first day of January 1950 with the idea, and this is his quote, of recording the great Negro artists of the South who had no place else to go. And it was really set up exclusively to record African-American artists. And he recorded virtually all of the great blues singers and a good number of gospel singers, although he never had any luck with that in the Mid-South area. But he had no interest in having a label of his own. And so what his idea was that he would do the recording. Sound was what Sam Phillips was focused on, sound and bringing out of someone a quality that maybe they didn't know that they had themselves. But the idea was to license the recordings to other labels, and that's what he did. And Chess was really the second major. He had just had a number one R&B hit on Chess with Rocket 88 by Ike Turner and Jackie Brenston. Wolf was the next person to come in the door. And when he first heard Wolf, he said, "This is for me. This is where the soul of man never dies." And I think that for the rest of his life, and Sam lived to the age of 80 and died in 2003, but there was never a moment when, for Sam, Howlin' Wolf was not really the pinnacle of everything that he had ever set out to do in the recording studio.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of that first record that he released for Sam Phillips. This is a song called How Many More Years? How Many More Years, first record released by Howlin' Wolf, 1951. How did that one do, Peter?
Well, that I think went to number 3 or 4 on the R&B charts, and the other side, Moaning at Midnight, went to number 10. So, in fact, the record was really the biggest chart success of Wolf's career, but it was just the foundation for a whole string of classic recordings. You played, I think, or you mentioned, I Asked for Water, She Gave Me Gasoline, and Smokestack Lightning and just a ton of other recordings, which are, you know, became the foundation along with Muddy Waters' work for the Chicago Blues.
And kind of interesting there, because you hear the piano. Obviously, Sam had an idea of how to arrange these songs, and up until then, Howlin' Wolf, as you said, playing by himself, only the guitar. Those arrangements sounded pretty good. Did he feel good about that, the way Sam was arranging his music?
I think so. I think that, you know, Sam would say that, you know, he was doing everything he could just to keep up with the Wolf, as he said. Mm. Wolf actually had a trio. He had the guitarist on that record is a guy named Willie Johnson, who is just a brilliant guitarist, and he had a drummer named Willie Steele. And it was Sam's idea to introduce the piano to give the song more body or more structure. The other side, but Moaning at Midnight, there is no piano, and but basically it was just a pure rhythm operation, and I think the piano was intended to give it a kind of form, and worked well. And Wolf, actually at the concert, one of the great piano players who played at this is the concert at Chapel Hill on Monday night. One of Wolf's great piano players, Henry Gray, is going to be playing with the band.
That's going to be this Monday night, a symposium at UNC Chapel Hill to honor Howlin' Wolf, and I'm talking with Peter Gorolnick today. Talk a little bit more about that radio show that he did, because that to me is interesting, and whether or not the money was in the show itself or promoting his upcoming gigs. How did it work for Howlin' Wolf and I guess others who had radio shows at the time?
For radio shows at the time, I mean, there had been virtually no exposure of African-American talent on radio up until that time, certainly not before the Second World War. And the only exposure that had been achieved was through gospel quartets like the Golden Gate Quartet, who actually appeared on network shows. I mean, had their own network shows. And I'm trying to remember, there was actually, I can't remember who it was, which quartet started out in North Carolina and picked up a national exposure. But as far as secular music goes, there was virtually none until the late 40s, 47, 48, 49. But you'd have these 15-minute shows, which were either in which either someone bought up the sponsorship or were sponsored, in this case, by a farm supplies company. And the whole purpose of it, from the standpoint of the singer, whether it was Sonny Boy Williamson or Howlin' Wolf or Robert Jr. Lockwood, the whole purpose was to advertise their live appearances in the area. So they didn't get paid at all. And, you know, I wish we had a recording of Howlin' Wolf's show. It was enough to get Sam Sam Phillips to recognize. He said he heard it over the worst transmission and the worst signal in the world, and he said from that moment he said, "This is what I've been looking for. This is exactly what I've been looking for." But Wolf, presumably the trio would be in the studio, and they would do a few songs. Paul Burleson of the rock and roll, of the Burnett Brothers rock and roll trio, is it? Who did The Train Kept Rolling?
Yeah.
He was at that same KWEM studio with another group, and he would play with Wolf on occasion, in that setting. So, I mean, it was a completely, almost a free-form kind of a thing, and the whole idea was just to sell.
It's a big old ad for your upcoming gig.
That's right, and then for the sponsor to sell their product.
Right,
whatever it was.
And so that's an interesting question, because you've got these desegregated airwaves in the 1950s in the South. Were they broad audiences? Were there white and black listeners? Could you tell? And was this how the music actually kind of made the leap?
Well, there had to be black and white listeners, because whether it was KFFA and Helena, you know, with Sonny Boy Williamson's King Biscuit show, or it was Howlin' Wolf. The point is, the stations were the only black station in the country at that point was WDIA, which called itself the mother station of the Negroes. I mean, it was followed by several other stations, but other than that, the African American music that was being programmed was on a predominantly white station.
Right.
So the audience was necessarily going to be mixed. It was just a question of how many people were going to stay from show to show.
Right. and whether they carry over and cross over, and they did, and his music crossed over as well. Songs like Smokestack Lightning, originally recorded in 1956, have been covered, I think, in almost every generation of artists since its release. I think The Who, Grateful Dead, Bob Dylan, John Mayer. Let's listen to the original. Here's Howlin' Wolf doing Smokestack Lightning. Smokestack Lightning, as I say, covered by a lot of artists, including label mate on Chess Records now, Muddy Waters at Chess Records, and they had a bit of a rivalry, didn't they?
Yeah, no, there was, I don't know if you could say there was no love lost, but there was definitely a strong rivalry, and I think the rivalry was propelled as much as anything by Wolf's extremely competitive streak, and even more, his self-competitive streak, the idea that he had that he was going to drive himself to give the very best performance he could in any situation. But Muddy was actually the guy who helped Wolf get started. He got him a gig at Silvio's, I think, in Chicago. He found him work when Wolf first moved up in early 54, moved up to Chicago from Memphis. It was Muddy who helped him. And maybe at the instigation of Leonard Chess, or you know, maybe just out of the goodness of his heart, and Wolf actually rented a room in Muddy's house, but the rivalry grew stronger, not weaker, over the years. And Wolf was not somebody who was prepared to take a back seat to anybody.
You know, it's interesting. One of the more interesting things about Howlin' Wolf's story is how unlike the typical, I guess, the stereotype blues story, Howlin' Wolf, by the time he got to Chicago, had a little bit of money, and he managed to keep his money, didn't he?
Yeah, now Wolf was very much of a person who believed in self-improvement. And not only did he learn to read when he was in the Army and was quite, he was careful about paying payroll taxes, or you know, taking the withholding out of the band's salaries. He was taking, when I towards the end of his life, when I spent a fair amount of time with him, he was taking guitar lessons from a guy named Cash McCall, who was a very sophisticated musician and was doing a lot of arrangements for Chess. And Wolf took this. I mean, he on the one hand, you listen to his music and you think, this is as primitive a kind of holdover as anything you'll ever hear. I mean, the music that, the blues that his music evokes are the blues of Charlie Patton, who's, you know, been labeled the founder of the Delta Blues, which is kind of a silly title, but he, so much of the Delta Blues comes out of Charlie Patton's work, and Wolf was the one who really carried it on. And Tommy Johnson, who whose brother Liddell said he really did sell his soul to the devil at the crossroads. So I don't know about that. But the thing is that while Wolf's music appeared to be so primitive, Wolf himself was a highly intelligent person who gave a great deal of thought to everything, had his own views on things, and was committed to the idea of self-improvement.
Peter, I know you. I've got about 20 seconds left. I know you've had a chance to talk with him. How is he personally?
Oh, he was just a fascinating guy. I mean, the thing was, he believed in himself, he believed in his music, he believed in the uniqueness of his point of view, and he just was not a pushy person at all. But at the same time, there was no time for small talk with Howlin' Wolf. He was going to tell you exactly what he thought.
Peter, thanks so much for telling us what you know.
Well, thank you.
Peter Gorelnik, music scholar and author of a number of books, including Sweet Soul Music, Rhythm and Blues, and The Southern Dream of Freedom, and a forthcoming book on Sun Records founder Sam Phillips. Peter's going to be part of a tribute to Delta Blues legend Howlin' Wolf, Monday, September 19th, UNC Chapel Hill. The event starts with a symposium at the Wilson Library and ends with a concert at the University Student Union. For more, visit lib.unc.edu. Coming up, the Friday Blues continue with Ruthie Foster on the State of Things. Stay tuned.